What's it like to be a foster parent in Illinois?
It is the hardest, most wonderful thing that we've ever done. Just knowing how to make them a part of your family, but also being able to make them successful when they go back to their biological family.
We'll hear from a Champaign foster mom and check in with foster care agencies throughout the state. Those providers say insufficient state funding makes it difficult for them to care for among the most vulnerable in our state, abused and neglected children. Plus, as Caterpillar prepares to leave Peoria, we go back to the company's modern roots in World War I.
Caterpillar has driven the entire economic engine of Peoria since it became entrenched here in the early 1900s.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we approach nearly 2 years without a budget in our state, we've been making a point to check in with agencies and organizations that have been impacted by the lack of funding from the state. Whether those are domestic violence agencies or drug addiction treatment facilities, we've heard about layoffs, reduction of services, or even shuttering of doors. Today, we shift our focus to foster care in Illinois. Unlike numerous other social service agencies, foster care agencies have continued to receive state funding throughout the budget impasse. But those who work in the system say that the state contract for foster care leaves important gaps in funding for services for the most vulnerable in our state, abused and neglected children. In a few minutes, we're going to be checking in with two of the directors of agencies involved in the foster care system in Illinois. But first, on the line with me is Amanda Kirby. She's a foster parent in Champaign. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Amanda, what was your journey into becoming a foster parent?
My husband and I kind of have an interesting journey. We are brand new foster parents just within the last 2 or 3 months, and my husband actually had a professional relationship with the child that we are currently fostering. And so when he went into DCFS care, we questioned to see if we could take him into our home and take care of him. And fortunately, it was a good match with my husband being in the medical field and me being a stay-at-home mom to be able to foster the child that we currently have. So that was our journey so far. That's been our journey so far.
Right. As you said, you're relatively new. I wonder what have been some of the biggest challenges you found with being a foster parent?
Definitely trying to figure out how to have a child in your home that you provide all of their needs and wants, but also realizing that they could go home. And there's actually a pretty good chance of that. Most of the time, the goal is reunification for them to go back to their biological parents. So just figuring out how to show them the love and attention and everything that they need, but realizing that it's for a limited time, and just preparing them the best that you can for them to go back.
Mm-hmm. From a logistical standpoint in it, I know that sounds like emotionally, I know that's something I've talked to foster parents about in the past, that is always something that everyone has to deal with, of being a parent and knowing that it may be or most likely will be a temporary situation. From a logistical standpoint, I had a question for you about if your foster child receives coverage for medical needs, does that happen through the state? Does that happen through your insurance? How is that working?
In our situation, all of his medical expenses have been covered by the state.
And do you feel like you've gotten enough preparation and support from the state through this whole process?
I really do. We have a lot of different services that we're receiving for the child that we have, and we have not had any issues getting what we needed for him.
Mm-hmm. What do you want people to know about foster care?
The thing that I said the most, it is the hardest, most wonderful thing that we've ever done. Kind of like I said, it's hard bringing a child into your home that, you know, it's just from a different background, just knowing how to make them a part of your family, but also being able to make them successful when they aren't a part of your family anymore, when they go back to their biological family. And then it's wonderful because you're getting to share so many experiences and opportunities with a child that may not be able to have those experiences otherwise.
Thanks so much for sharing your story with us, Amanda. I really appreciate it. Amanda Kirby is a foster mom in Champaign. Thanks for being with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I wanted to bring two more people into this conversation as we're talking about foster care. Ruth Jaco is the Vice President for Children's Services at Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. She's on the line from Des Plaines. I'm also joined by Gary Hilsman. He's the CEO of Caritas Family Solutions in Belleville, just east of St. Louis. Ruth, Gary, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Ruth, can we start with you? As you heard Amanda's story, she was sharing both the joys and challenges of being a foster parent. In her situation, she was talking about feeling well supported by the state. I wonder, is that the case for many foster parents throughout Illinois?
Well, I thought Amanda did a wonderful job of really describing her experience and what she is doing. I think she called it the hardest and most wonderful thing we've ever done. And I think a lot of foster parents would say the same. And I'm glad her support has been so excellent. That's wonderful to hear. I think for many foster parents, because, for example, we have a lot of staff turnover for child welfare caseworkers. So if Amanda and her husband continue to foster and they have, you know, a caseworker for 6 or 9 months and then, or a year, and then another one and another one.
Right. She's just been doing this for a few months. Mm-hmm.
Right. But that becomes, it takes a real toll on a family. You have to retell your story all the time. You have to re-educate the new worker about the needs of your child, about the needs of your family. You're not going to be able to continue to get the support that you need to do that hardest and most wonderful thing you've ever done. It becomes quite a challenge and puts quite a burden on the foster parents not to get that regular, consistent support from one caseworker for the life of the case of the child that they're caring for.
And I think that makes a lot of sense, Ruth, when you're talking about the infrastructure. I wanted to ask both of you about data for reimbursement rates. I was looking at some data about how much foster parents get reimbursed. I have to say I was a little horrified when you look at how Illinois ranks in terms of other states and nationally suggested averages for how much parents are supposed to be reimbursed. First, Ruth, foster parents in Illinois don't get salaries for taking in children, correct?
Right. They get a reimbursement for expenses related to the child. Depending on the age of the child, the rate is about $400 to $500 a month, a little bit more for an older child. But I think most people raising a child would think that they need more than $400 or $500 a month to care for that child.
Right. And so that's the numbers that I was looking at. We tweeted out a chart on this, by the way, if you follow 21st Show. According to the University of Maryland's independent research, as you said, Illinois provides $418 for a two-year-old. The suggested standard is actually $777. For a 16-year-old, Illinois reimburses $511 a month, and the national standard is $976. That puts us about 86% behind, Ruth?
Yes.
And Gary, go ahead.
That is really that's really a minimum number. It's not even an average. It's a minimum adequate rate for foster children. And the foster parent you had on here, those are wonderful when you take a non-related child and they might have resources. Many of our foster parents are actually people like grandmothers on limited incomes of the child. So they're home of relatives. And they have, oftentimes they don't have as adequate of resources. And they need to be with relatives. Sometimes they have enough resources and sometimes they don't. So it makes it very difficult for some of the children to get all their needs taken care of. So it's a complex web of support that we have to have, giving various and sundry demands of any one child that you have. And over a course of many children, there tends to be large gaps in some areas.
And as we go through all of those gaps, just to stay on the reimbursement for a moment, Gary, when was the last time, I know there's legislation right now that's being proposed in Illinois to change some of not just the reimbursement rates, but a lot of the structure and funding for the system. When was the last time we saw reimbursement rates for parents in Illinois increase?
I think it's been several years, and it was very modest, maybe 2 or 3%. And
I believe that was back in 2014, am I correct? So that was 3 years ago?
And it's hard to keep track of all that, but 2014 seems like a reasonable time that it's been. But as you can see by the in comparison to other national averages, Illinois is incredibly, woefully inadequate to sustain these children in our system.
Gary, what role do agencies like yours play in the foster care system? Can you explain that?
I can try in the short amount of time we have. Really, 85 to 90% of all the care for children, the case management of children in Illinois is done by private agencies. And so there are agencies like Caritas, Family Solutions, and Lutheran Social Services, and others. The number of these agencies that are doing foster care, by the way, is shrinking and shrinking rapidly. And it's shrinking because the rates are completely inadequate to maintain workers' salaries, infrastructure, rent, electric, gas, and transportation for caseworkers to visit the homes on a weekly or a monthly basis throughout the rural regions of Illinois or even the urban regions of Illinois. And maybe a 2 or 3% increase over 10 years. The contracts that we have now are basically, in essence, the same contracts we had, with just tweaks here and there, 10 years ago. And in that 10 years, we've been required or demanded or have compliance issues that are piled upon us sort of repeatedly. Some of them make sense. Some of them don't make sense. Some of them need to be advanced or updated. And the workload on our caseworkers are enormous. And they come into the field wanting to do tremendously good things. And for the most part, they do. And for the most part, the private agencies do a great, fantastic job with performance. And these are performance-based contracts. So the agencies that do that have a higher performance rate get more children and more referral opportunities. And so there is a system in the state that sort of the best care sort of rises to the top, in essence. But there's a parallel system going on. There's sort of a state system that has a certain rate or compensation that is maybe 40 or 50% higher when you're a state worker versus a private agency worker. Oftentimes we find ourselves, our trained, licensed child welfare workers being poached, essentially, by state agencies because they can get trained workers. And that causes us to have.
And do they get paid better, I assume?
They make several tens of thousands of dollars more doing the exact same job.
If they work for the state versus a private agency such as yourself. Wow.
Right.
Ruth, can I ask you, as Gary's talking about the reimbursement rates, as Gary's talking about funding and the funding gaps, a lot of people may be surprised. You know, a lot of people think it's a foster care system. Even though we haven't had a budget, money has been flowing to you all. Is that an accurate depiction of what's happening for you all, Ruth, with Lutheran Social Services?
Yes, because the state of Illinois child welfare system operates under a federal consent decree as a result of a lawsuit that was brought many years ago by the ACLU, DCFS continues to pay private providers and others, and it makes sense that they would do so. These are children for whom the state is the parent in all intents and purposes. They are the guardian of these children, and I'm responsible for my kids, and the state of Illinois is responsible for these children as well. So it is imperative that they continue to pay for their care, and they do. The thing that I think impacts us, and I'm sure it impacts Gary down in the southern part of the state as well, where LSSI operates and as well, is that other types of providers that are not getting paid or are getting paid slowly, like providers of domestic violence services, substance abuse services, mental health services, those are the key areas that usually families that become involved in the child welfare system have a problem in one of those three, if not all three of those areas. And so if the funding for those kinds of ancillary services is cut off or slow, or those kinds of programs are being shuttered, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, then it really impacts what is available for us to hook our families up with so that they can address the issues that brought their children into care and get them home again.
So, Ruth, I understand for you all in particular at Lutheran Social Services, how many people have you had to lay off particularly in regards to these sorts of services?
Well, I don't know if I have all of the numbers. The primary thing that LSSI closed was services to seniors, and we did shutter those services in many parts of the state because we were not getting paid through the Department of Aging for those services for homebound seniors, for example. So that's the primary thing that we have reduced at our organization.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that one staff person in particular was laid off recently who helped oversee a summer program for kids.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there are places where even within the child welfare division, we have reduced because, as Gary mentioned, you know, with the rate being inadequate and other costs continuing to go up around rent and, you know, trying to keep pace with any kind of salary for new staff coming on board or other kinds of expenses that you're having in a program, the other kinds of extras that we used to be able to afford for some of our kids, we have a difficult time affording. For example, we had a person in Chicago who was kind of ran a mentorship program basically for our teens in foster care and did a lot of activities with the kids throughout the year, a weekly support group for them, activities, opportunities for them to get out of their neighborhood and see other parts of the city, to go on outings, to go on a summer camping trip in the summer, you know, those kinds of things. That's just the kind of extras that we used to be able to afford that we simply cannot find the resources to continue to do.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation talking about agencies that work with foster care children throughout the state, how they have been crippled by the state budget impasse and the lack of funding. We're going to talk about some legislation, some ideas to also help solve this situation. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we approach nearly 2 years without a budget, we are checking in with different agencies and organizations impacted by the lack of funding from the state. Unlike numerous other social service agencies, foster care agencies have continued to receive state funding throughout the budget impasse. We've just been hearing about the federal consent decree, but we've been talking to people in the foster care system about the funding and what exists, how the impasse has affected other agencies. It's having a ripple effect on them. My guests are Ruth Jaco. She's Vice President for Children's Services at Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. Gary Hilsman is also with us. He's the CEO of Caritas Family Solutions. He's on the line from Belleville. So we've got both sides of the state talking about this issue. Gary, we were just hearing from Ruth about how Lutheran Social Services is handling the funding, the lack of increase that you all have had. I wonder if you can give us a sense of what specific things you all have had to do with the funding that you have received and knowing that there's an increased need out there.
Right. So we really have to understand we have to invest in our communities and our families. And we have a program called MST, Multisystemic Therapy, which is evidence-based practice to keep sort of children in their homes and out of, say, detention centers or out of the foster care system and so forth. That program has not been paid since we've been providing the work, but we haven't been paid since last July. And what we've done is we've worked on getting grants and doing fundraising events.
Gary, how much money does the state owe you?
On that program, about, I want to say, $150,000, somewhere in that round. It's a small program, but very impactful. And we have a couple of therapists and a supervisor that have to do really advanced training and around this particular model that goes into the home and does intense interventions with families, usually with court-involved youth or with youth with special type of needs. And it's very cost-effective. In other words, you pay us $8,000 to do very intensive intervention versus $80,000 to send them to a state detention center. Mm. And so it's a huge return on your investment, and everyone wins. So the taxpayer wins, the child certainly wins, and that's what we're staying focused on. And, of course, the family and the communities in which our families live also win. And it's all interconnected, and it's interconnected in a way that has a profound impact. I mean, we do pull down federal dollars, so the foster care, you get more kids in foster care because those other services aren't there. And that's every month for the past almost year, maybe 8 months, maybe just 1 month that we didn't get it because we were lacking caseworkers, trained caseworkers to take the cases. But every month we're at a record high in the number of cases that we have. Last month alone, we had 2 full caseloads, 30 additional cases just in 1 month because there's an increase in the number of kids coming into care. And we don't want that. We'd rather have children stay in families. We want children to be safe, and that's all part of the foster care system. But we want to invest in our families and our children in a way that allows for people to be healthy and well. And right now with the budget crisis, it's getting increasingly more difficult because the infrastructure itself is starting to crumble.
And Gary, when you talk about the infrastructure crumbling, I want to take a step back for a minute and ask, when we talk about the foster care system, obviously the goal is always to have children reunited back with their biological families. I was looking at some numbers in a report, and I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well, because his story was what sparked this conversation. Isaac Smith is a reporter with the Southern Illinoisan. He's on the line from Carbondale. Hey, Isaac, thanks for being with us as well.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity.
Isaac, you know, I was reading in your story about the rate of, I guess it's permanency, right? And where does Illinois rank in terms of returning children back to their biological parents?
That's interesting. I think I might have gotten that number from Gary. I believe it's dead last or close to dead last, which is definitely not a good place to be in.
Yeah. Gary, go ahead.
Yeah. There's 51 jurisdictions, so we're number 50.
Wow. And Gary, why is that? Because you're talking about sort of all of the state budget impasse affecting all of these other programs. We hear a lot about substance abuse, poverty being factors that ultimately lead children to be removed from their home and ending up in foster care. Gary, can you help us understand the interplay of how this may be further affecting getting children back reunited with their biological families?
And that's I'll see if I can hit the highlights. There's a complex interaction between the fact that Illinois tends to remove kids only when they're at the most serious states. They have other programs that some states don't have where they try to, like, intact services that keeps children in their homes. So that's a factor. Another factor is when you have the child welfare system providing the services and you have high turnover rates, the chances of moving the children through the system in a more efficient or quick manner, it slows it down. When a caseworker has to start over, it takes 2.5 months longer for a child to reach that permanency, which we want all our children to reach. And so then it starts stacking up. And so there's been a lack of investment in the infrastructure itself in order to reduce in some form or fashion that turnover rate so that the children can return to a safe, permanent situation. And about 2/3 of all children do return back to their homes, and about 1/3 have to either be adopted or have independence or guardianship or some other type of permanency. What I want to emphasize is that what we're trying to do with this legislation on rate increases in a variety of ways, whether it be with foster parents or with the foster care system itself or residential treatment, is the fact that it would be cost effective to invest in it in order to get us from that 50 percentile to more typically where Illinois is on a lot of other factors is in the middle. That's, we have a long way to go there. And this is what we really need to emphasize with the legislature and the state government, that we have to attend to this before more bad things start happening. And one of the most intrusive things the state can do to a person besides capital punishment is to remove a child from their home. And we have to take that in a very serious manner. And it has a huge impact on children for the rest of their life as to how we handle that. And it would have impacts down the road if we don't care for those children in a very healthy way, in a way that helps that child grow and develop and become productive members of our society. And right now, we're not adequately investing in that.
Ruth, I know that you all with Lutheran Social Services, you do a lot of work with trying to keep kids with family or relatives. And I wonder, as we are looking at what Gary's talking about, maybe foster care is getting funding. How does it, what kind of impact does it have if, for example, domestic violence agencies or addiction treatment facilities are not getting funding? How does that affect the work that you do?
Well, it's the same thing that Gary's talking about, and that's that length to permanency. So Illinois, it takes fewer children into the system, as Gary mentioned, but once we get them, we hang on to them for a much longer time. So it's just that length of time that it takes us to get a child to a permanent situation, whether that's returning home or being adopted. And so when those services are not available for their parents to receive, you know, timely intervention around substance abuse or domestic violence, whatever it is, then that's going to slow it down. When their caseworker is changing every 9 months or year, that's going to slow things down. When the foster parent is not receiving adequate support, adequate reimbursement for the care that they're providing for the children, and that foster parent, you know, maybe can't continue to care for the child and the child moves placements, now that's another setback. So any of those kinds of disruptions, whether it's in service or in the personnel or in the foster parent home, all of those things just delay getting the child to a timely resolution of the situation, getting them home or getting them into an adoptive resource.
Isaac, for those stories that you all, so the Southern has been doing, Isaac and his colleagues have been publishing stories all focused on the issue of child abuse in Illinois, with an eye, of course, to Southern Illinois, where rates of child abuse are 2 to 3 times the state's average. We're going to tweet out the links to those stories. It's a month-long series by the Southern. It's called Protecting the Innocent. Isaac, what do we know, what have you all learned about what's behind as we talk about this, obviously, in many cases, children who are entering foster care system are because of an investigation into child abuse. What do we know about why rates in Southern Illinois are 2 to 3 times higher than the average?
Well, there's a lot of mitigating factors there. And the reporting that I've done and all my colleagues here, there's about five other reporters working on this with me. There's sort of a laundry list of things that you could look at. You know, poverty as a result of poor local economy, which the state budget certainly isn't helping that. This, you know, adds stress to families that can then lead to substance abuse or, you know, acting out on that stress, be it, you know, with a partner through domestic abuse or child abuse. You know, those are all certainly factors that are kind of sparked by the budget and again, relate to what was already kind of a struggling economy down here anyway. But another thing to sort of point out is, you know, there were, I think, looking at my notes, in fiscal year 16, there were about 245,000 calls to the state abuse hotline. About 78,000 of those were substantiated and, you know, charges were filed or something along those lines. But something that's good to keep in mind there is there's been a lot of education over the last, say, 5 to 10 years that maybe has empowered more people to make calls.
Ah, okay. So maybe more people are reporting because more people are recognizing signs of abuse?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the work that we've done has pointed in that direction. And that's certainly not the only factor there. I don't think we could say that, you know, there isn't more child abuse down here. I don't think anyone that I've spoken with has been able to, you know, authoritatively speak to that. But I do think education has been at least part of that equation.
Mm-hmm. What other kind of efforts are being made in Southern Illinois to help prevent child abuse, other than, I know you're saying, encouraging reporting?
Well, I think, you know, that is definitely one thing. You know, some interviews that I've done this week for a story that we'll be publishing later in the week, and not to give too much of that away, but certain organizations, be it through DCFS or, you know, Lutheran Social Services, are working to sort of clean up maybe some redundancies in bureaucracy in from when children enter the foster care system, and maybe trying to find other ways of getting parents treatment to sort of reunite them with their kids, but also, you know, potentially prevent, you know, future incidents of abuse. A big part of that is education. like with parenting classes and things like that, how to deal with, you know, a child that's testing your nerves, for example. One of the stories that I did, you know, brought up a really good, it's not a new idea, but it certainly resonated with me, that where do we learn to parent? Well, we learn to parent through how we were parented. And so maybe trying to work with parents to break negative habits.
Right.
That's one thing that's important.
That sounds like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Ruth, you know, as Isaac is talking about all of these things, and I'm thinking particularly about substance abuse, I wanted to ask you about what that looks like. When we think about, we hear so much about the opioid epidemic and what that looks like across the state, whether that's in rural areas or urban areas. What are you seeing in terms of, does that have a correlation to everything that we're talking about as well?
Certainly. You know, there's in our Chicago area, we have significant opioid use. In our southern region, there's a lot of methamphetamine abuse, and that, you know, there's both in both places as well. But those are kind of the trends that we have seen now for several years. And certainly, if a family is struggling and all of those underlying conditions that Isaac was talking about, you know, lead to situations where children may be unsafe, may not be supervised as they should be. You know, parents become focused on their addiction and not focused on the care of the children. And so, you know, those can create very risky situations for children. One of the things that the state of Illinois does, and Gary alluded to it, is provide what's called intact family services. And so for a lot of those calls where a hotline call is made, an investigator has gone out, they've determined that there is a situation that is abusive or neglectful for children, but perhaps there is a way that we can intervene first before bringing the child into foster care. We can intervene with that family in the home and try to get the family and the parents into the services that they need, maintain them in the home, or maybe bring in a safety plan with grandma or somebody else who can help provide some extra supervision while parents are attending to their services, and try to prevent the child from coming into foster care in the first place. And so I think that's a big trend that we see across the state of Illinois. I know for LSSI, almost all of our intact family services programs, like I've just been describing, have been above contract numbers all year.
We're serving more families.
No. We're being paid for everybody.
Okay.
We're being served. We have like a maximum, you know, you're going to serve 100 families, and then we end up serving 130. And we get paid for all of the service that we provide, but just meaning that kind of the guesstimate that the state has given us about the number of families that they think they'll need to refer to us, it's been more.
Okay. Well, lots of different issues here. I know that, as I said, some of this, in a lot of these issues are in the series that the Southern is doing. We are going to tweet out all of those links. All of that will also be at our website. Isaac Smith with the Southern Illinoisan on the line from Carbondale. The series is called Protecting the Innocent. Lots of different things that they cover, not just what we are talking about here this morning with foster care agencies. But Isaac, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I want to also thank Ruth and Gary, giving us a sense of what it's like for different foster care agencies throughout the state. Ruth Jaco is Vice President for Children's Services of Lutheran Social Services of Illinois, on the line with us from Des Plaines. Gary Hilsman, all the way on the other part of the state from Belleville, just east of St. Louis, where he's CEO of Caritas Family Solutions. Ruth, Gary, thanks for being with me as well. I appreciate you giving us a sense of what things look like for you all right now.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for having us share
our story. We appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks so much. Stay tuned. The 21st continues next with a look at Caterpillar. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Caterpillar is one of our state's biggest companies. It ranked the fifth largest of Illinois' companies on the Fortune 500 list. Caterpillar has called Peoria its home for nearly a century. Earlier this year, the company announced that they will be moving their global headquarters out of Peoria to Chicago. Just last week, we learned that new location will be in Deerfield. Today, we're going to go back to the very beginnings of the company and learn how they went from being a company with thousands of employees in Illinois to hundreds and thousands of people all across the globe. To learn more about this, I'm joined on the line from Peoria by Chris Kjærgaard of the Peoria Journal-Star. Hey, Chris, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Good morning.
I feel like before we go to the history, we have to just start with the present really quickly, which is just Caterpillar did have some earning results out this week. Just from the company's health perspective, what are things looking like now?
It begins to appear as though the company is turning the corner on the economic downturn that they had been facing, brought on largely by the mining sector. We saw on Monday reports of actual sales of implements from them that have increased year over year. And then we saw on Tuesday come out an earnings report that reflected those increases in sales and actually saw positive growth for the first time in 10 quarters.
So that
begins to show the effect of the company scaling back on its employees, on beginning to shutter facilities, and have kind of brought expenses into balance with costs.
Right.
Or with profit.
Sure. And we'll get into some of that a little bit later. I wonder if, given that, sort of putting that news to the side for a minute, we can come back to, you know, Caterpillar. I'm just thinking of this, of Caterpillar and their earnings and how that's now something that's followed by, you know, dozens of reporters probably across the world, right, are reporting on Caterpillar and their financial health. I wonder if you can talk to us about what Caterpillar was like. You have a story. We'll tweet out a link to it about Caterpillar's history. If you could take us back to World War One, you spoke with Caterpillar's lead historian about how that was sort of when the company became what we know as modern day Caterpillar Inc. You describe Caterpillar as one of having, you know, this lasting legacy from World War One. What do you mean by that?
Well, in essence, without World War One, the company likely would not have grown in the way it did and with the speed that it did. The company, or rather two companies prior to World War One, Holt Caterpillar Company and C.L. Best Tractor Company, had been continuing to grow. Holt was the more established of the two companies. It was, in fact, doing global business even before the war, largely to European, both companies as well as estates, which needed large-scale machinery for the maintenance of estates and, in fact, had a major order from the Austro-Hungarian Empire prior to the outbreak of World War One. So Holt was an international company even before the start of World War One.
What kind of things were they making?
At that point, it was primarily just tractors, which were used for earth-moving on for the maintenance of estates, even for dragging things as you were beginning to get into a mechanized climate rather than having horses to pull carts and things like that on large-scale estates for the rich throughout Europe and, to some extent, the United States. Some of that, which I'll get to in a moment, plays into World War One, and you also had the upstart Best Tractor Company that was operating and beginning to innovate around some of the same ideas. At the outbreak of World War One, you had generals over in Europe who recognized, coming in many cases from the upper classes, the utility of having that type of equipment, not just for earth moving in constructing bulwarks against enemy advance and working at the outset of the trench area, but almost more importantly than that, for the transport of material and maintenance. Horses were in short supply, particularly as the war went on and more of them were killed. Horses were requisitioned from throughout England to bring to the front for transporting some. Now, the advantage of a tractor is a tractor doesn't get tired. A tractor doesn't need to get fed. It's easier to purchase a tractor, and you can use it all the live long day.
Right.
So yeah. The Allies placed orders for those tractors from Holt Caterpillar Company, and that sort of began the supply chain to the Allies.
Right. So that take us back. So that's so we're going back literally 100 years ago, right, when the U.S. entered the war, April 1917. Whole Caterpillar, as you're saying, contracted by the government to build these tractors. This caused a huge employment boom for the region. At the peak, how many people were being employed in East Peoria?
It's difficult to quantify the exact number at the peak, but what the company historian has said is that prior to the war, as a global company, they were employing several thousand people. With the wartime orders, which from the Allies and the United States in particular, effectively came as a blank check. Build us as many tractors as you possibly can. Transition the company from thousands of employees into tens of thousands of employees. And the bulk of that work was being done in Illinois, out of East Peoria, because of the ease of transportation to the front, either downriver through the Illinois River and then shipped overseas, or by rail from Illinois to the eastern seaboard and then by ship, both easier than shipping out of their other plant location in California.
Right. And so obviously that makes a lot of sense in terms of thinking about, would we have then seen during that time a lot of people moving to East Peoria, were a lot of people moving there, or were they people who were already employed, who were already there and now got employment for the company?
It was a huge employment boom for the area and would have drawn regionally as they were continuing to boost their hires.
Mm-hmm. And so they were building tractors. Did they also make tanks?
They didn't make tanks themselves, although the company did experiment and build several prototypes. They had major backers in the military, and in fact, Black Jack Pershing, who commanded the Allied Expeditionary Forces, the American forces fighting in Europe, had experience with Holt tractors during the Mexican expedition to fight Pancho Villa on the Mexican border a few years before the outbreak of World War I for the United States. So he was a big proponent of purchasing them. He and others certainly encouraged the company to work to develop prototypes, but none of those prototypes ever really got off the ground. The idea for the tank, though, helped come from Caterpillar equipment, the Caterpillar being the description for the tread that they used.
Oh, interesting. Oh, so the idea of the tank that we know today came from a Caterpillar tractor?
Correct. Yeah, the British general who helped develop tank warfare and helped develop the initial tanks over in Britain, Ernest Swinton, credited Holt Caterpillar Company with the idea after seeing those Holt tractors in operation.
After the war, what happened? You mentioned, so there's this Holt Caterpillar Company and then this upstart Best Tractor. What did these companies then, did they merge during the war, or was this after the war?
They merged after the war. Holt had effectively ceded the entirety of the domestic market. They went all in on building for the military and for the war effort, and that allowed an opening for Best to begin to sell domestically. So at the end of the war and the few years after the war, you have Holt with all of the money and the production capacity from having built during the war and supplied the Allies. You have Best, which has been innovating and has begun to make some serious inroads in the American and the domestic market, but doesn't quite have the production capacity and doesn't quite have the monetary resources to fully fund a takeover. The two of them need each other. One is the upstart that has the energy in the market. The other one has the capital and the resources. So it was a natural for them in the mid-1920s to merge and make use of each other's benefits.
So, Chris, were there actually training camps as well that were set up outside Caterpillar for soldiers?
There were. Caterpillar had a facility, Camp Herring, which was effectively run by the company. Employees would work on the production line during the day, and at the end of their shift, they would actually bring their guns with them and store them in the lockers. At the end of their shift, they would go to the training camp and would train soldiers on how to use and how to repair the Holt equipment when it was on the front.
As you're sharing this, I'm sure there are probably listeners in the Peoria area who are probably connecting and thinking of family members or other people they know who were involved in the company. For folks who are listening to this, our listeners who are outside of the Peoria area, I wonder if you can sort of explain the significance of Caterpillar in Peoria today, especially as we're a couple, you know, we're a month or two out now from the announcement that after more than 90 years of being in Peoria, they're going to be relocating to Chicago.
In large degree, Caterpillar has driven the entire economic engine of Peoria since it became entrenched here in the early 1900s. The community has grown with Caterpillar, not just in terms of employment at the company and its facilities, not just in Peoria, but in the suburban area surrounding Peoria. But in addition to that, we've developed other supply chain services that are reliant on Caterpillar as a company. The recreational life, the not-for-profit life in Peoria is in many ways aided and supported by donations from and volunteering from people who work at Caterpillar. And as you look statewide, the influence elsewhere is also significant, with the company also having facilities in Pontiac, in Aurora, and, of course, now with the move up to Chicago as well.
Yeah, and now so Deerfield. Did they say now what would have Cat officials said about why Deerfield was chosen for the new location for their global headquarters?
From the moment they made the announcement, they made it clear that a significant reason behind it was ease of access to transportation, not necessarily for shipping equipment. They know they have that in all of their facilities in Illinois, but ease of access to transportation for their executives as part of being an international company. In Deerfield, we're talking about a very brief drive for them to a private jetway at Pewaukee Airport in the north suburbs, and a very brief drive for them to get to O'Hare International Airport to catch any of the daily flights from there to China, which has become a major, major market for the company. Mm-hmm.
Certainly also Walgreens based in Deerfield. Walgreens executives have been very familiar with that as in terms of a major global company headquartered in Deerfield. Wanted to ask you before we let you go, Chris, one other thing that Caterpillar has been very much in the news for, an ongoing federal investigation. Can you remind us what's going on with that? Give us an update on the latest from the federal raid that happened across Caterpillar recently.
Certainly. And the questions there revolve around the company's involvement in what may be questionable tax practices with overseas subsidiaries of the company based out of Switzerland and parts that are produced in the United States and where those parts are given credit for being. That's an ongoing investigation that dates back multiple years. It was the subject of U.S. Senate hearings, is the subject of a dispute between the company and the Internal Revenue Service over the amount of tax owed. And there are also, potentially, based on information in the search warrant, outstanding questions on the company's export practices to some countries across the globe that may have opened sanctions against them. We really have not had much of an update on where that investigation stands since the raid. Obviously, it was a huge trove of information that was taken during the raid, and it may take a while for federal investigators to digest that and to bring any of that information to the grand jury that we know has been hearing the case out of the Central District of Illinois.
It's Chris Kjærgaard with the Peoria Journal-Star. Chris, we know that you guys have been providing lots of information on that investigation. We'll stay tuned for you all for the latest from that. And we will tweet out that link about Caterpillar's history, how World War I helped forge modern-day Caterpillar story that Chris did for the Journal Star. Chris, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That does it for us today. You can always find all of the information on how to contact us, past shows, everything at our website, 21stshow.org. That's where you can find our links to iTunes and Android, directions for sending us an email, leaving us a voicemail, and following us on social media. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montesilio. Abar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.